This is Amateur Logic, episode 204, for April 18th, 2025. Amateur Logic is brought to you by ICOM. Whether you're chasing DX, experimenting with digital modes, or leading a local net, ICOM radios deliver crystal clear performance and seamless connectivity. I'm George.
I'm Tommy.
I'm Emil.
I'm Mike.
And it's great to be back for an April episode of Amateur Logic.
Yep. Still April.
The bugs are starting to come out. Emil has been swatting them a little bit down there. Good evening, Emil. How are things going?
Pretty good, George. Pretty good. I'm taking this role of slacking seriously tonight, so if I seem disconnected, it's because I am.
Because you disconnected?
Tell me what's been going on with you.
Not too much. Been playing around with Meshtastic stuff a good bit.
Yeah.
Just that and working, trying to keep the grass cut, stuff like that.
Yeah, don't remind me. I need to do that tomorrow. I actually needed to do it 2 or 3 days ago, but maybe I'll do it tomorrow. Mike, are y'all cutting grass up there yet?
I was grinning when Tommy made that comment about cutting grass. We had snow on the ground yesterday, just enough to cover the grass, and I guess by noon it was gone. But we had rain this morning, and we're supposed to get more over the weekend.
Wow. Yeah, I think we're going to have a little rain down here.
Yeah, starting on Easter.
Yep.
My grass was about yay high. My mower had been broken.
You found the mower?
Yeah, I finally found it.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was broken. I ordered parts for it, and I actually bought a new one too. So I got two mowers now. No excuses.
One for each hand. That's all I got.
That was a nice try.
This is a special day.
It is.
Yes.
Well, it's Good Friday.
It is. It's Good Friday. And it is also World Amateur Radio Day.
Woo-hoo!
What?
Every April 18th, radio amateurs around the world take to the airwaves to celebrate World Amateur Radio Day. It was on this date in 1925 that the International Amateur Radio Union was formed in Paris. And that's what World Amateur Radio Day is about.
Not about you now talking around the world?
Well, it is. It says they take to the airwaves. Have you taken to the airwaves today?
I did.
At lunch.
I talked to across town to a guy that was going to get lunch.
Actually, I was only a few blocks from you when I
ID'd the first time. But my town's small.
Well, yeah. Yeah. So, congratulations. World Amateur Radio Day.
Cool. Everybody pat yourself on the back.
Yep.
I saw that on the Radio Amateurs of Canada site, and I looked at it, and that contest, believe it or not, only runs on, like, today. And normally, most of those events run for at least a couple of days anyway, but I was really surprised that it only runs one day.
Well, how long could World Amateur Radio Day be?
Well, that's true, but by the time the viewers get to see this, it's going to be over.
Yeah. You know, we've got a friend who is probably in the chat room tonight. I didn't notice. Emil, did you see Terry in the chat room earlier?
Yeah, he's in there.
Terry is in there.
Terrence is in there. Yes, he is here. Hello, Terry.
You know, Terry's a good friend of the show here, 2E0IPK over in London. He sent us a little video here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it.
You know, I've never been to this place. Well, I've never been out of the country. I have been to New Orleans a few times now.
There you go.
You could count that, maybe.
You
could
count that.
Hello, I'm Terry, 2E0IPK. Short time ago, I went to Bletchley Park which is about 75 miles from me, something like that. While I was there, I picked up A4 pamphlet things, and one for George, one for Tommy, one for Mike, one for Emil, and one for me. And lo and behold, my one's different. Typical. I didn't see it at the time. I just picked up five, paid for them, and then got them home, and mine was different. However, it doesn't matter. I will go back there. When I go back there, I also intend to get more footage of Lorenz, which is my next project anyway. But I took some stills and some normal video footage while I was there. And, I think you'll like it. So let's have a look at that.
Okay, this is inside the National Radio Centre, and they've got lots of equipment like this in there. Miles of it, and these tubes or valves, I thought I had a lot in there, but Mike beat me on that one, so fair play to Mike on that, on his video, what he did. This is inside the actual shack of the National Radio Center, where they actually have JY1, King Hussein of Jordan. They have his equipment in there as well. I wish I'd videoed it, but there was something going to go on in there. This is outside the mansion, which did feature in the film, The Imitation Game. And it's quite a nice place in there. Got a great library, as I'll come to in a minute. But part of this was added later. I don't know which part they did say. But I think you can tell anyway. This is inside the library. This is actually just a few photos of it. We've actually got video on here as well. But I don't know whether this furniture is reproduction or basically it's real, but this is the way they had it all figured out. And that's, they said that this is probably how it was set up at the time. I can't say that for certain, but that's what they say. Here we go. This is the library still, and this is obviously video of it. And it's really lovely. It does give you a sort of a feeling of this is actually what was going on at the time. This is how it looked. And I like to believe that anyway. I do like to believe that that is part of it. But as I say, whether this stuff is reproduction or not, I don't know. But this is such a lovely place. It's a great little area. One of those places I could work in easily. Better than our libraries nowadays around here. And you have to live in Dagenham to understand that one. But really great. Yeah, this is Commander Denniston's office, and I wouldn't mind working in this place either. This is quite a nice little office he's got here, or he did have. And he was in charge of the site, apparently, from what I can gather. And really well furnished in there. This is the main ballroom. This was actually featured in the Imitation Game. It's the only part of it that was, apart from the outside of the mansion there. And I'm not too sure of this. I take it that this is maybe how it was set up at the time, but they didn't have pots of jam on there, so I don't know whether they still use this or what. That's something that I want to find out. And maybe next time I go there, I will find that out. This thing was playing all the time. It was playing all old songs, which I've obviously had to get out for copyright reasons. This is Alan Turing's office. And you will notice there that his mug for his tea has actually been chained to the radiator. They said that that is exactly what he did. Now, as I say, this is all laid out as it would have been, or they perceived that it would have been at the time. I don't know that, but really is a, great to go and visit anyway, anytime. Yeah, the dispatch rider bike. I love these. I wouldn't mind one of these myself. I do like bikes, but I've never really been a bike rider. I can't see the significance of this car. I know it was used at the time, but I can't remember what it said on the board. So, but it's a lovely car anyway. It looks great. Here's another dispatch rider's bike. is actually in the garage. This is all in the garage, this bit. So, you know, that's all I can sort of say about that. Ah, Enigma, my baby. Yeah, Enigma is obviously in a case in there, but this is what it's like. You've got the plug board there, the three rotors. There are actually five rotors with every Enigma supplied. You'll see that in a while. But then on the rotor, there's a Roman numeral. And the Roman numeral is the number, obviously, for that wheel. And the wheel and all of its settings can be changed. And really great. Now, this is what I'm coming up to now. Take a note, make note of TAG, or TARG, which is German for day, 31143. They're the rotors I'll be using. And ZNO, or ZNO, I don't know the significance of that, but you will see it, believe me. And, yeah, I mean, they used to use this daily setting. They had a sheet. This here is my FTDX10, and this is just literally the Morse code decoder. And even this type of thing wouldn't have helped at that time. Even the technology today would not have helped then. Amazing. Yeah, I had to leave that running. I do like the sound of the bomb machine. Well, I hope you like the footage that I took there. And I mean, I know there isn't really a lot of it, but I mean, you could quite clearly see the things on there, like the bomb machine and other stuff that they have there, including the garage, which I thought was an excellent place. But there you go. I deliberately left Enigma till now. I've not really shown you a lot. That was last on that bit of video there. But I want to add a little bit more to that. Only, I mean, I haven't got an Enigma, you know, here. And I can't really show you a lot, you know, on it anyway. But I can tell you how it worked. So just take a look at this and see what you think of this. And I'll come back to you at the end again. Okay, so I need to make good that claim, and I will do that right now if I can. And I hope you can all keep up with what I'm doing here, because I'm not the greatest explainer of things. I don't have an Enigma, so I got this emulator using that address, that web address. And it's free for anyone to use, which is good. So on that sheet that I showed you, I'm using the settings with ZNO or ZNO. Depends where you live. I mean, it's Z over here. I'm a 68-year-old man that's grown up using the word, the letter Z. So there you go, ZNO or ZNO. And basically, they had to change that. That was there on the settings sheet, as you saw. But in case it fell into the wrong hands or something like that, they were told that they had to do or to change it. And they had to change what was called the indicator. And they had to work on the indicator. And this is what they had to do. So to change that, what I'm going to do, I'm going to change that to JDX. JDX. And now it's a double encryption. So we do it again. JDX. Now, if you come down here, that is what I've just typed, JDX, JDX. But the ciphered text is HLOZRD. HLOZRD, I mean, you look at that and you would think, yeah, nothing. There's nothing with that at all. I mean, you saw the part with my with my radio Morse reader, and that's all that would come out with. So it was totally useless. So what he would do, he would be starting the one at the other end. ZNO, apply settings. What he would do, he just received this, and he would type in HLO. Z, oh, it's at the top, isn't it? can't get that right. Z, was it? RD. And then you see on there that he's actually now changed it as well. And he can see this now as JDX. And then they would both change their wheels to JDX, which I'm going to do now. The I've got essential tremor. I don't know why they call it essential tremor, because it's not essential to me, because I don't want it. Right, so JDX, we've got up here now. So now they would have both changed their wheels to JDX, both of them, because that there was the changing of the wheels. So now the first one would type in his message. So on this occasion, we'll just go H-E-L-L-O. Hello, yeah, okay, fine. So he sent in hello, but he's got AYXJQ. That don't really help much, does it? So we've got to remember that he'd changed his wheel already to JDX. So he's on JDX, and he will type in AYX. AYXJQ. And then he will see the message. Hello. And that is how it worked. Now, how they worked that out from that, I don't know. Because when Arthur Sherbius invented this in 1918, it was for the compute. I keep saying computing. For the commercial and banking industries. And it was meant for them, and it didn't really get used a lot. And then Hitler saw it. He liked it. He gave it to the Reichsmarine, who was the forerunner for the Kriegsmarine, and that was the German Navy. And they used it all through the war. Later on, they went on to use Lorenz, which is totally different. It doesn't use Morse code. It used Bodo code. That's the one I'm going to look at next, but I won't bore you with that. Anyway, I hope you like this, and yeah, there you go. Well, there you go. I mean, there's nothing more I can add to that. Hope you found that interesting. Well, you know, if you did, then great. I will be going back there again, because I want to now learn a little bit more about the Lorenz machine and how that worked, because Lorenz was actually Hitler's communications with his generals without the other ranks knowing anything about it. And that uses Bodo code, as I said in that bit of video there. It was totally different. There was one operator who sent a message of something like 4,000 characters. I mean, 4,000 characters is a lot. And then somebody said on the other end, sorry, we didn't get all of that. Can you please resend? Yeah, okay. But anyway, he had to do it. And he abbreviated, and they caught onto it. Now, don't know how on earth they caught onto it, but caught onto it they did. And that helped them actually break Bodo code in the end. And, you know, that was a 12-wheel machine what they were using. So totally different to, you know, the Morse code and that. But anyway, I hope you like it, and I'll see you again soon. Terry, 2E0, IPK, off and clear.
Thanks, Terry.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, Terry.
Very good, Terry. Thank you.
Next time I go over there, that's definitely on my to-do list to go there.
And he mentioned,
yeah,
he got us all one like this, and he thought he had one more for himself.
Yeah.
And it was different.
Yeah.
For some reason. Anyway, thanks for this, too. And we have an ultra top secret message there.
Yep.
If you'll set up the wheels, we'll decode this.
Okay, I'll get on it. We'll do it during the next segment or on the break.
Okay, that'll be a good time.
How did it feel being a cipher, y'all?
A cipher. You know, if you look down the list, your call was
next.
You
were on there, too.
I felt important.
Yeah, and then Mike as well. So,
pretty cool.
Very interesting.
That was great. Appreciate you sending that in, Terry.
Oh, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. He's always got cool things, unusual things. And, of course, we've all heard of the Enigma machine, but I think his description of actually using it to decode something was kind of helpful.
Yeah. I have to go back and rewatch that movie.
One of my duties at the W5SLA club is occasionally patching some of the OSs on some of the devices we have at the repeater site and other places. So when I did that this last time, I noticed on one of the PiStar images on a Pi that we had running that when I did the updates, it updated the entire app. It's been a while since that's happened. So it caught me off guard, and I decided to go ahead and check around and look around and see what was happening. And sure enough, the PiStar group starting to develop new images, new versions, and there's even a beta that's higher than the one you see here available, and you're getting all kind of inputs on their Facebook support forum. And if you go actually look at the PiStar site, you'll actually see the new versions of the image, the Pi. They give you the whole image ready to go. So some news and action on the development on the PiStar this time. I noticed that. So I'll check it out because it's like I said, it's been a while. But looks like they're starting to get back into it, which is really good for security reasons and other reasons too, you know, functionality. Hopefully we'll see some differences and new things. So check it out.
Cool. Did you notice anything right off different?
Well, the dashboard, to be honest with you, no, the dashboard always has that little date in the upper right-hand side. And I noticed when I did it this time, you know, it was probably pointing to a year ago, but of course it changed to last week. And that caught my eye. I'm like, wait a minute. Something's going on here. But as far as new functionality, I don't see anything new. I think they're trying to catch up with all the updates that have been happening on the OS side, right? Because, you know, they're not going to stay still on the Pi side.
I think they're updating for some new stuff coming out, too, kind of setting the framework for that. I updated mine as well, but I didn't notice anything different either. Yeah,
I haven't yet. I was going to wait and hear how it turned out for y'all before I did.
That's about right.
There you go, Tommy. We're the testers.
I'm used to it.
Yep.
Combining cutting-edge technology, unmatched reliability, and user-friendly design, ICOM's amateur radios are the gold standard for ham radio enthusiasts. Whether you're chasing DX, experimenting with digital modes, or leading a local net, ICOM radios deliver crystal-clear performance and seamless connectivity. With a legacy of innovation and commitment to quality, ICOM continues to set the benchmark for amateur radio excellence, making them the trusted choice for operators worldwide. Introducing ICOM's IC7760, the pinnacle of base station excellence for amateur radio enthusiasts. Designed to deliver unmatched performance, the IC7760 features state-of-the-art technology, exceptional RF clarity, and an intuitive interface, all housed in a sleek and durable design. The base station features a separate remote control head and RF deck, providing excellent flexibility for installation. Place the RF deck closer to the antenna feed point, freeing up space on your desk. You can also connect the control head to the RF deck through your home network, enabling remote operation from anywhere in your home without need for a PC. Pair the IC7760 with a powerful ICPW2 linear amplifier, and take your contesting experience to the next level. The ICPW2 seamlessly integrates with the IC7760, delivering a massive power boost and enabling enhanced long-distance communications with DPD, digital predistortion, and a built-in 2x6 automatic antenna selector for SO2R single-operator 2 radios. Together, they define what's possible in amateur radio, setting a new standard for global connectivity and reliability. For more information about all of ICOM's great amateur radios, visit icomamerica.com/amateur.
I'm sure you guys remember the day that the sun went out over here recently.
Kind of, sort of went out.
In the middle of the day, more or less.
Yeah,
not as much here as a little further north. We had an eclipse, and actually I showed some of what I did during the eclipse here. DX in the AM broadcast band. Tuned in to medium wave there and captured the whole spectrum because there was a, an experiment going on by the folks at HAMSCI.
Hamsci.
Hamsci. HAMSCI.org. They're the organization that does ham radio science and radio and various related projects. And they asked people to go capture some of that and submit the files to them. And we went over it here on the show, and I went out and identified some of the stations that in the middle of the day, you know, I was picking up from Chicago and just all over the place that you'd normally never hear on AM radio during the day here. But I got an email because I submitted my files to them. And it goes like, the HAMSCI workshop last month in Newark, New Jersey included a presentation on the medium wave eclipse experiments in which a number of data sets were mentioned in the text and all were credited for helping to make the experiment a success. Now, there were two different eclipses that they were watching here, the one in 2023 and the recent one in 2024. And this is a slide deck right here that they sent a link to. It's such a long length, I didn't try to put it on the screen here, but it'll be in the show notes. Approaches to identifying medium wave signal enhancements in high-psi solar eclipse data. And this PDF document right here tells you how to go through that data, because these files are being made available on the internet for anyone who wants to download and help to sift through this data and see what they can find. In other words, in my case, I captured the whole AM band and I uploaded it to the HAMSCI folks. The 2024 data is not out there yet, but the 2023 files are. And they tell you in this document how to go search through those files and help to discover AM radio propagation as it moved across the U.S. during the solar eclipses. And they show right here, there were 27 participants in this event, and you can see they're kind of scattered, most of them in the area of the eclipse. One guy right here just south of it in Mississippi.
I know another guy down that area that recorded it too. I think all stuff's still sitting on his hard drive.
Who was that?
Me.
You recorded it too?
Yeah.
You didn't submit it. Or is this your dot too?
I don't know. I don't think I submitted it. I don't remember. I don't think so.
Yeah. So that's my dot right here. And this is 26 other dots of other people. And many of them right in the direct path of the eclipse there instead of off from it a little bit.
If I'd have known I'd have got a dot for it, I would have sent it in, though.
Well, there you go. I didn't know it. You know, that's just like money in the bank right there.
I know.
But, I experienced some excellent eclipse propagation way down here in Mississippi because the stations that were getting eclipsed over, or their sky waves were occurring in the middle of the day, and you could hear it down here. They've got a lot more details on there, you know, as to how to go through, how they're sifting through the data right now, trying to determine how Eclipse affected the medium wave band. And you can participate too. All the information you need is right in there. And as I said, the link to this presentation and more information are going to be available on the HAMSCI website. In our show notes, you can go grab yourself a copy and tune along at home. Even though the events already happened, all the data is there. You can just open it up, and you got the same thing anybody who was trying to do it live would have seen.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, there was more stuff. Well, that's going to be coming. Like I say, the 2024 data files haven't been posted yet, but they are coming. The 2023 is out there. So I might go download some of those and sift through it myself. It's
the data I recorded was a pretty big set of data.
Oh, huge, yeah.
It's like, I want to say it was like 800 gigs or something. I don't know. Remember, it was a massive amount, though.
I don't see it on this email. I did read it on the website, though. I'm going to be wrong in saying it, but I think it was mentioned around 20 terabytes they ended up with.
Yeah, this is quite a big download. Yeah. I hope you're not on dial-up.
That won't fit on a USB stick.
No, not any I have.
That is cool, though, how they do the sourcing, you know, let people participate in that. And then give you the results of the data. I mean, it's kind of reminds me of the old SETI at home days. Remember that, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I used to do that.
like right now, some of the data sets are at Dartmouth College, and they're looking through it, trying to find Doppler shifts during the eclipse. And, all that stuff's going to be publicly available.
I was following them closely for a while. That was a couple of years ago, but they're still going strong. They have another project. Something about GrapeSci is one of the URLs that they have in addition to their main site, and it's a custom PS or PCB with components on it, and you can decode data. And I can't remember exactly if it was for meteors or other types of data, but you have to go to the main website and read all about it, because it's quite interesting and they're quite an active group. I get a daily digest that I get, I think, once a week, and there's all kinds of stuff in there. You have to read through it.
The main thing they're trying to do with this data now is to identify the different stations that were picked up from each location to kind of plot out what occurred during the eclipse. And the way they're doing that, like, you know, the stuff I showed here, I listened to the audio till I could hear call letters or something that would identify the area of the country or the state that the station was in. But they're doing tricky stuff here, like measuring Doppler shift. And some people had recorded stations in advance of the eclipse for 24 hours. And if they had GPS-disciplined oscillators driving the SDRs, they can go back and track that stuff down to minute frequencies and determine this was this particular station, because they were like, I don't know if this is exactly correct, they were like 0.1 hertz low for the frequency. So they can identify how much it shifted. Yeah. And, so they're doing all kinds of research with
that. That's pretty neat stuff. I used to look at the website. I need to start checking it out again. That's pretty cool stuff.
Speaking of pretty neat stuff.
Yeah?
You're up.
Oh. that was my segue, and I totally blew it. I missed it. I've been playing around with some more of the Meshtastic stuff. I got a new little device, kind of made things a little bit nicer to play with it. But anyway, let's check it out, and we'll talk about it at the end. Well, my last segment, I went over Meshtastic, got it set up on the little Heltec V3 device. And I was going to do a range test this time using my cell phone, but I actually got a T-Deck Plus in since then, and I got it set up. Not having to use my cell phone kind of changes things for me. I got a little dedicated device, and let's go over that, and then next time we'll go out and do the range test. If I have time at the end, we may take a little ride and just kind of test it out a little bit and see how it does, but not sure how the time's going to hold out. It's a lot to cover here, so let's get started. This T-Deck came in a nice little box. Cost around $80 or so. I shipped from China, but you can get them off of Amazon. They got it before the tariff stuff started, so I don't know if it's going to be more now or not for that. But when I first got it, it came with Meshtastic on it. It had this same little black and white looking screen, although I think it was green. Wasn't very useful, wasn't very user-friendly. I didn't like it at all. So recently, they released a 2.6 firmware for it. Kind of changed it, turned it into a whole new device. It's more like a BlackBerry. You can see it's a BlackBerry-style device. Pretty nice looking. Got the little QWERTY keyboard, reset button, expansion port, I think, for whatever. It holds a SD card up to 32 gigs, power switch, and got speaker down here and a USB-C on the bottom, which I've got hooked up to my computer right now. I'm just going to show you how to flash it. I've already flashed this one. I'm not going to redo it, but I'll show you how to go through the steps to get to the 2.6 firmware. So a little trick to it. It's if you're a gamer, which I wasn't, something called a Konami code, I believe, and it gave you extended lives or unlimited lives on some certain games. I think they were Konami-made games. And you have to know that code to get to the newer firmware. It's an alpha pre-release firmware, but it seems to work pretty well. To get into flasher mode on this thing, we'll hold down the little ball. This is a little thumb wheel ball, track ball type thing, and it also clicks. So if you hold that down, turn on the power, which is unintuitively down, is on this thing. It just looks like that does nothing, but it's actually in flash mode. Let's go to the computer, and we'll go back to flasher.meshtastic.org like we did before. Today we're going to select a device. We're going to pick a Lilligo T-Deck, even though mine is a Plus. The Plus has a touch screen. It's a little bit nicer, I think. So we'll pick that. You can see, they've updated it. So we are going to flash it today. Let's go ahead and do it and see. 2.6 wasn't available here before. Let's see if the Konami code still works. So we go up, up, down, down, left, right, BA. Screen turned black. Technical preview. That's the one that I'm actually running right now. But these are later builds. So I'm going to go with that one. Let's go ahead and flash it. We've got to do a full erase and install. And we want to do the Meshtastic UI. That's where the magic is. So let's go ahead and install it. We're doing this together. Same steps we did with the other one when we flashed it. So let's let that run and do its thing. Okay, it finished. It says leaving. That means it's done. And we will power it off. Back on to see what it looks like. 2.64. Before it said 2.60. I think the one downside of this device, the main one, it's probably more than one. It's not perfect, but it's much better than having to use your cell phone. But the CPU on it is pretty slow, which I'm sure it is, so it's efficient battery-wise. It pops up with some default stuff. Okay, it's asking for the region, which is the U.S. We want a name, which I'm going to use the same one as before. And click save. Now it's going to reboot. Just like everything, it always reboots every time you make a change. This is not exactly what I intended on doing my segment on, because I wasn't going to flash it again. But since the new one's out, I figured we'd go through that together and check it out. To wake it up, the only way I know to wake it up is to hit the trackball, push it down, go down to the gear. We'll look at everything. It's long fast. It's a client. Wi-Fi is not set up. We can do that. Just tap that, put in your Wi-Fi stuff. Down here at the bottom, there's a tools menu. So there's some utilities under here. Mesh detector, you can scan for other mesh devices nearby. Signal scanner, trace route, statistics. If you go back to home, well, then I'm on. So if you hit the nodes button, you can see in 5000, which is the one I'm on. This one's 2. Channels that are set up, messages, if you have any messages, maps. And there's some maps here that need to be configured. Well, first of all, we've got to set up the GPS. So let's turn on the GPS too. So for GPS, you go down here and find it. There's the GPS. You can see it's grayed out. If you hold down the icon right there, it'll reboot and turn it on. Then the maps will work. Now, the maps don't come by default on it. So I downloaded those maps from this link right here that will be in the show notes. Make a folder on your SD card called Map. Download, unzip the maps and put them into that folder. Now, it took a long time for me to write those to this SD card. Apparently, I've got a really slow SD card. And it took me like 3 or 4 hours, I think, for them to finish writing. I just let them go and left. It's a bunch of files. So, okay, there's the GPS. We can see that we've got a location now. That's my SD card here. Shows how much space is used. It's a FAT32. Shows our LoRa frequency, 906.875 here. So let's reboot this one. And we should see a signal pop up here. It only announces every so often, so I'm just doing that just to rush it. That's all configurable. Okay, now we got a signal. Apparently you changed the timeout. Signal noise ratio 7, RSSI minus 20 is 100%. So it should be, since it's right there, we're almost touching each other with it. Let's go ahead and turn on the Wi-Fi. If you hold down, you see the Wi-Fi is on because this is enabled, but we've got a 0.0 IP address. So let's go ahead and get an address. Hold the icon down again until it reboots, and it'll come back up running. Now we've got an IP address. So we want to turn on the MQTT stuff. So let's hold down the icon underneath that one. It says mesh/US, which will get us into the MQTT US channel. Kind of, if you're not familiar, refer to the last month's segment about some more of these details. I think we're going to have to go into the device and turn on MQTT because it's not connected. So to do that, we're going to go into the settings again, go all the way down to the bottom, where you reboot or shut down, hold down the Bluetooth button. That'll reboot it with Bluetooth on. Then you use your phone and connect with Bluetooth and turn on MQTT like we did in last month's segment. I'm not going to do it now because we don't really need to do that for this test. Then you can use this one device to do everything. You can get the messages off the internet if you want to turn that off. Let's go ahead and just do it. Channels. Long fast. And we're going to have to do uplink enabled, downlink enabled, so they'll go through the internet. And save, send, close. This thing should reboot again. To get out of programming mode, just hold down the button for the Bluetooth. Okay, if you hold it down for a while, it reboots, comes out of Bluetooth. So, see there? Turn the Wi-Fi back on. A lot of rebooting goes on with this thing, so just be patient with it. Let's see what we got. Okay. Wi-Fi is on. We've got an IP address, and we're on Mesh US, so we should start getting some messages coming in here shortly. 1 of 26, 27 nodes, 26 of 32. It starts running up. Go ahead and reboot this one more time so the signal shows up, just to speed it up. And there it is. So basically what we've got right now is a Meshtastic device that goes through MQTT on the internet as long as we're on our Wi-Fi. And you can send and receive messages to anybody. We also got another node connected here that we could use to send messages locally. I did turn off the MQTT on this one earlier today before I started my segment. And I'm going to turn it off here and we're going to go test it out. turned off the MQTT part. I'm just going to leave it connected to the internet, but I don't want the MQTT traffic to go. I'm going to go put this one outside, up on the little ledge of the little treehouse thing I mentioned before. And then I'm going to go get in my truck, and we're going to take a drive with this one and see how far we can see it or hear it. Okay, I'm in my truck now. I've got my T-Deck, and I've got the Heltec out there on the little treehouse thing sitting up. It's probably about 15 feet off the ground, which is high as I can get it right now, using the little default antenna that came with it. I've got high gain ones to put later, but I'm just going to see if, how far I can get a message back to it. I'll make a note as I go along. All right, I made it to the post office here. I'm probably about 2 miles from where I live, from where the thing is. So I'm going to hold the T-Deck out the window here and try to send a message that says post office or P.O. Easier said than done. And let's hit send and hope for the best. Well, I don't have much hope for it from the post office here because I did a scan. Assuming the scanner works on here, this is all alpha code, but assuming the scanner worked, I didn't pick up my note at home. So. Okay, let's try this again. I got a new one in here now, a new message. I'm pulled over at a doctor's office. It's between my there where I was in my home. I'm going to try to send that one. And I did. Let's try that scanner again. And still got 100%, which is what it had at the house. I don't think it really works well. Well, I just got back from my little short-range test. It was a little disappointing, although I'm not really surprised. Let's take a look at it. So, from the T-Deck, I sent some messages from... I got one that says P.O. here from the post office, but I did not receive it at the house. The first one that I started receiving was one that says DR, which is at the doctor's office, which would be about, right, actually it was exactly right here. So let's see if I can measure. Measure from there to here. 2,077 feet. So a little less than half a mile, third of a mile maybe. Kind of disappointing. And then I got some more from, I got one from here at this traffic light, which isn't surprising. And I got one from here when I was turned into my neighborhood, which is not surprising. But I did not get one from the post office, which I sat right here and I got completely out of the truck, which would be, let's see, 3,475 feet. But you can see there's a lot of things in between. There's a lot of trees. That office, that doctor's office is in the way. Several houses before it gets to my house. I'm going to see if I can work on that. So that'll be an upcoming segment. Hope you found this useful. If you're interested in it, the T-Deck is the way to go because you can do MQTT with this thing, get messages through the internet, and not have to fool with your phone at all. And it just makes it so much nicer. You can get them on Amazon or from LilyGo, which is the manufacturer of it. LilyGo.com, I believe. Link will be right here. 73.
That was the default antennas, the ones that...
Yeah, it's the little ones that came on the little hotspot Heltec device and the one in the T-Deck. T-Deck Plus, but I've got some. You can upgrade them, both of them, and I've got some at home. I'll try that. I might do it next time. It just depends, or I'm not sure. But sometime here in the near future, I'm going to swap them out and do that try again, see how it works. Should work a lot better. I understand the one in the T-Deck is pretty poor by default. So
yeah.
Should do
Tommy,
better.
When you're going through the Wi-Fi settings, I noticed there were settings for LoRa. I'm wondering if that supports LoRaWAN and if you've ever tried to connect via LoRaWAN.
No, I haven't done anything with that. Now, the mesh stuff, it uses the LoRa radio, but I haven't done anything else with it.
I've got a device from Seed Studio, and it's going to be in an upcoming segment once things get going here. I've got my greenhouse. It's It's a little device that you can connect various sensors, like moisture meters, up to it. And it supports LoRaWAN, so I'm going to try connecting via LoRaWAN. I don't know. I haven't done too much experimenting to see whether how the coverage is. I did have it working at the office, as long as I stuck the main unit in a window. I was able to pick up and connect to the LoRaWAN, which was kind of interesting. So I'm going to have to try it out where I'm at and see if I can get connected to LoRaWAN to send the information back to my house from the greenhouse.
Tom mentioned something about the wobbly video in the truck. Sorry about that. I was actually hand-holding my action cam. I stabilized it, and I was stable, but the rest of it was kind of shaky, so I should have probably used the suction cup, stuck it to the windshield, but I didn't.
Action packed, Tommy.
I know.
That just added to the effect right there.
Yeah. Seemed like I was traveling at a high rate of speed. So it's on the ARRL news site. The Utes are at it again. So at Hamvention's coming up.
That's next month. Yeah. I'm going to be there. Anybody else going?
I'm afraid I'm probably not going to make it this year. Again, ARRL is inspiring the next generation of amateur radio with a full day of fun, learning, community building, and on-the-air activity. Registration is open for the ARRL Youth Rally at Dayton Hamvention. This amazing event is set to be a great day full of hands-on radio activities for people age 11 to 21. So you just barely missed that, George.
Just my luck.
Join fellow young people who are interested in ham radio, led by volunteers from the ARRL Collegiate Amateur Radio Program, as they make a fun day out of getting to know radio and each other. There will be an on-the-air sprint, contacts with a parachute mobile station, which sounds pretty cool, a kit build in the youth lounge, and a fox hunt. While Hamvention offers free tickets for the youth age 12 through high school, advanced registration for the youth rally is recommended. Youth rally registration fee is $20 and includes a t-shirt to wear on Saturday, badge, lanyard, and a reusable tote bag. ARRL Youth Rally is always a full day of smiles, fun, and empowerment. Make sure you young hams join us at Dayton.
You know, there's another Ute thing going on as well.
The Utes are everywhere, man.
Yep. The inaugural Yoda Junior Camp for young amateur radio operators under the age of 15.
I know he wants to.
Missed it by this much. It's in North Central and South America, and it's scheduled to take place on July the 25th through the 27th. The camp will be held at the National Voice of America Museum of Broadcasting in Westchester, Ohio, USA. Yoda Jr. is a three-day weekend camp for young hams to meet with other young hams, participate in unique experiences with radio-related technology, and build relationships with mentors and peers. The camper application period is open from now until June the 1st. For additional information, please visit youthontheair.org or contact the camp director, Neil Rapp, WB9VPG, at director@youthontheair.org.
Cool. Yoda, what was it? Yoda Jr.?
Yoda Jr.
Otherwise, I loved him in The Mandalorian.
Grogu. Yeah, that was Grogu.
Wow.
On the air, youth will be.
There he goes. Mike. Help yourself, you cannot.
Yeah.
I would have been disappointed if you didn't.
Tell us about that power supply behind you, Mike.
Well, actually, you know what? I wish I had a... well, you'll see in the video how big it is, but it's pretty tiny. And if you look at the specs there... whoops, wrong hand. The output is almost 70 amps when you feed it with... 110, 120 volts. But if you feed it with 220, it goes up to a whopping 82.3 amps on 12 volts. So anyway, it's kind of overkill, but there's obviously a huge dynamic safety margin there. and you'll find out. Let's have a look at the project.
DIY 50 amp power supply. Newer hand rigs require an external power supply generally. I needed one to replace my trusty Drake PS7, which is a linear transformer type power supply. It's big, it's heavy, and it recently started acting up on me, so I decided, well, maybe I should have a look at switching power supplies. They're a lot lighter, and they seem to be very popular now that they've managed to engineer them so that they don't produce nearly as much noise as they did about a decade ago. So I started looking around, and I realized that I had a couple on hand that I salvaged from some old servers. I'm going to take a look at modifying them because they supply a lot of current. It'll certainly meet my needs. And if you look at the specs on this particular one that I have, it's pretty amazing how much power they're able to deliver on the 12-volt rail. Now, it also has 5-volt rails, and I think it's got minus 12 and minus 5 on it. We're not going to be using those. Anyway, I'm interested in the 12-volt rail, but the 12-volt rail is not ideal for ham radio equipment, and you'll see why in the next slide or two. 13.8 volts is a standard operating voltage. Most radio equipment labeled as 12 volt is actually designed to run at 13.8 volt. Running at 12 volt can cause low transmit power, voltage drop issues, increased current draw, potentially instability or shutdown. Why the confusion? 12 volt is a nominal label, but in reality, equipment is engineered for 13.8 volts, and regulated power supplies for ham gear are built with that in mind. The bottom line is, use a 13.8 volt or well-regulated power supply set to that to ensure your radio gear runs as intended. Anything much lower and you'll lose performance. I did some searching around the internet, and the best information I was able to find are actually from the rcgroups.com site. That's a bunch of guys that are into RC modeling, and they've been using these converted server power supplies to charge their lithium polymer batteries, and they've been doing it for years, so there's quite an extensive amount of information on their site, and I managed to scour through the various threads in order to come up with what was needed to modify my particular power supply to 13.8 volts. You'll see in these next few slides how easy it is to actually accomplish that. First off, we're going to need an enclosure for this power supply. So I did some searching and I found these Hammond manufacturing ABS plastic instrument enclosures. And these just happen to be a 1598 series case. They're made out of ABS plastic, comes with the ABS end panels, which makes it really easy to cut out for your design. This next item is an on-off toggle switch. It doesn't have to be anything in particular. The specs are pretty minimal because we're only controlling the signal line of the power supply. Okay, we're going to need some means of connecting the power to our radio, so I like to use 5-way binding posts. You can use Anderson power pole connectors or any type of other power connector that you like, as long as it's capable of handling the 50 amps of our power supply. I like to put meters on my power supply, and the easiest and most economical way to do this was I found these watt meters on the internet that are capable of reading power in terms of amps. In this case, we're not going to be using this, but it also measures ampere hours and watts and voltage. So again, this is the easiest way to do it. I just removed the case and incorporated it right into my power supply. Okay, don't laugh. This isn't a joke. I actually used a wire coat hanger to secure the power supply inside the case, and it worked like a champ. I like to use 10 gauge for my power cables, for my HF rigs and other radios that I have that require a lot of current. You can see that the power supply is almost a perfect fit for this case. I've mounted the front panel with the LCD display, which is the actual multifunction meter, I guess you could say. and you can see the two five-way binding posts as well. Here's where I use those wire coat hangers. I just bent them to form the outside of the case of the power supply, and it just so happened that the power supply fit exactly in between those plastic turrets at the bottom of the case, and the wire coat hangers snugly fit inside there. Here's a wiring diagram of the power supply and the few modifications I had to make for adjusting the output from 12 volts to give me 13.8 volts. As you can see, it only requires a potentiometer. Multi-turn pot is probably a good idea here, and a fixed resistor. And on the next slide here, you can see the power enable switch for your power output on the power supply. Here you can see the power supply is almost completed, with the exception I still yet have to install the power enable switch. The power supply has an integrated IEC 14, which accepts an IEC 13, or your standard computer power cable, and the arrow there that's shown on the top indicates the airflow direction. It's a flow-through design, and the air flows through the front and exits the rear of the power supply. Because the front panel blocks the airflow to the supply, I needed to cut some slots in the case to allow for proper airflow. Here's a pro tip that I use on all my projects that require ventilation slots or holes. I cover them from the inside using a piece of perforated aluminum mesh from an old satellite dish. They look great, they work well, and they prevent anything from shorting out if you accidentally should happen to drop something through those slots or holes. Here's our completed power supply mounted in its case. I've just temporarily labeled it with a label maker, but using my technique that I demonstrated in the BitX40 segment that I did a few months ago, I'm going to create a front panel to make it look a little bit more professional. 7-3 from VE3MIC.
Nice.
I mentioned that it supplies minus 5. It doesn't. It supplies 3.3 volts. That's not a big deal because we're not using that anyway.
So I noticed it, what was it, 13.88 volts? So
yes, that's one of the things I wanted to mention. So that potentiometer, you can vary the voltage slightly. But the thing is, if you go over 14.4 volts, there's an over-voltage protection circuit in there, and it'll cut the output of the supply. So if you go too high, it'll cut the supply right out. So that's why you can't jack it up too much over – well, you can't really jack it up. As soon as you go above 14, then it's going to shut off.
Yeah. Well, that gets you better than 12, which is what your typical computer power supply will tap out at.
And the other thing I was going to mention, that watt meter, it's designed for 50 amps continuous. It will spec out to 100 amps, and you know, unless I run the supply on 220, it'll never reach that. But I just figured we'll just spec it out at 50 amps and leave it at that, because I don't think there's too many ham radios that need more than 50 amps. I don't even know how much power amps use, but they generally need more than 12 volts anyway. So
yeah,
that was one of the things that I didn't mention in the video, that I was limited to the specifications for 100% duty cycle. So I decided just to limit it to 50 amps, even though it'll handle more.
Sharpen up your pencil, Emil. What's the cost, Mike?
I didn't really price it out. I think the case was the biggest expense, and I think it was about, I don't know, $15 or so. And then you've got a toggle switch, which is, you know, a few bucks, and you've got a fixed resistor and 10-ohm or 10K-ohm multi-turn pot, and I managed to find those in my junk box anyway, so zero cost there. And my 10-gauge wire I didn't even have to buy because I already had a spool of it that I bought years ago, and I'm still working on that same spool.
So 15 bucks?
Yeah, I would say so.
Impressive.
All yeah, right. I was pretty happy with it.
You know what I learned from that video?
No.
What? Excuse me. Go ahead.
Mike learned the dark side of the Force. You saw the lightning coming from his fingertips, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, you noticed there was smoke involved, too.
Yep, I saw that. Thing had so much power, it couldn't contain it.
But I didn't cause any blackouts.
No.
Especially at the Super Bowl.
Yep. They still haven't prosecuted you for that yet, have they?
I know nothing.
This mysterious tower showed up at Area 51 on Google Earth. And I've read some of the claims from various news or websites, I guess you could say. Nobody knows what it is or what it's for. And I don't know either. But there's a strange triangular structure if you go on Google Earth. And I think, let's see, if you go to the website, I think it even gives you the, right there under the picture, there's the longitude and latitude. And other than that, I don't know too much more about it, but if you have any questions, you can email me at Emil@amateurlogic.com.
Okay. So, I mean, obviously, Tommy, that's a cell phone tower, isn't it?
It kind of looks like
we've got one just like that over here. Yeah. Email's seen it.
I just passed it up the other day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of reminds me of that monolith they had on the moon on 2001 Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last time I looked at Area 51 on Google Maps, it was grayed out. They wouldn't let you see anything.
Yeah. I heard that too. It was kind of anything that was in that restricted area was kind of blurred. But I guess they figured maybe the Chinese and the Russians already have that information from their spy satellites. So what the heck? They might as well open it up to Google. I don't know.
Yeah.
Mike, George, I think they might be on to him talking about Area 51 because everybody in the chat room saying they just went back 30 seconds and the whole thing went blank.
Oh, they caught us.
Didn't
Well, before we get out of here tonight, this is Good Friday. It's also World Amateur Radio Day. It's also an action-packed episode of Amateur Logic number 204 with alien towers, a mesh-tastic adventure,
a solar eclipse,
an Enigma machine. Yes, some excellent eclipsing, and email swatting mosquitoes because I suspect they're starting to come out.
Is that how big they are? There was something that flew by earlier when you were on close-up, and I wasn't sure if that was a moth or what was flying by.
There's some June bugs in. Yeah, there's some June bugs around here, even though they must not know it's only April.
Yeah. Wait till about July or August when he's sitting out there on the porch.
I look forward to that. He'll be in one of those suits, like a beehive keeper.
Yeah.
With the mesh screen all around him.
Yeah, he's going to be dripping wet with sweat if he's out there in July and August in Mississippi.
Any final thoughts for this exciting episode?
No, I'm just waiting for it to end so I can go get those coordinates and find that tower on here.
Yeah, I noticed you've been looking real hard over there and hadn't come up with it yet.
No, it's got to be there.
Yeah. Email, any thoughts from down there?
Yes, it was a pleasure being the ultimate slacker and Yoda on this episode. And I just wanted to tell you, George, to be on the lookout within the next few weeks because I hooked up with my buddies over in Kentucky that we featured a couple of shows ago. And might have something coming your way.
Oh, okay.
Would that be another SWOTA episode?
No, it's not going to be SWOTA, but it also won't be first class mail.
Okay.
But probably in that box.
My mind's blown, yeah. All right. Well, thanks for the warning. Let's see.
Yeah, don't you threaten me.
Incoming!
Mike, any final thoughts from up there this month?
Well, hopefully, and I don't want to jinx myself, but I just hope we're done with the snow. It's been one long winter, and I'm tired of the snow. I thought on my adventure when I took the month off and I was traveling down the West Coast through the Panama Canal and in southern Florida, I figured by the time I got back here, I wouldn't have to deal with any of it, but I came back to quite a bit of snow.
Yeah.
It's all gone now, finally. But like I said, yesterday morning, I woke up to snow, and it was almost enough to cover the ground totally. Wow. And like I said, by noon, it was thankfully all melted.
Yeah, we didn't get any this season, did we, Tommy?
Not that I know. I don't think I even saw a flurry.
Down south.
It was a little flurry, I think. That's about it.
They're back for a second month. Wow.
Me and Marty are going to tag team it. So come join us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'll be this Tuesday, April the 22nd at 8 Central Daylight Time, 0100 UTC.
Come on, let's have a good show, and everybody put your reminders on.
Tommy, that's a mighty nice-looking shirt you've got there.
You like this?
Yes.
I like it, too. It's one of my favorite ones.
I noticed it when you came in, and I probably will when you leave as well.
Yep.
Because it's on the back, too. But what if a guy didn't have a shirt?
And it's, well, it's kind of summertime, but you should probably have one anyway, because some places won't serve you.
You know, nobody should see that.
No shirt, no shoes, no service.
So. We can't help you out
with
the shoes.
No dice.
You can go to shop.spreadshirt.com/amateurlogic and you can get you some cool swag. Get you a shirt. You can get cups, caps, all kind of cool stuff on there. Hoodies.
Yeah.
It's kind of warm for a hoodie right now, but it's going to get cool again Monday. Unless you're in Canada, it may be tomorrow.
Could be. Yeah. You know, Hamvention is, wow, that's like practically a month away. I'm going to be there again. I'll be helping stream Contest University, and I don't have the dates in front of me. I should have, but that'll be on DX Engineering's YouTube channel.
Cool.
It's a good event, yep. Whether you're a DX or not, or contester or not. There's some really good information on there, and the stream is free, so if you want to watch it, or you can go back later, and it's going to be captured on YouTube, and it'll be available, just like last year. Anyone else going this year to Hamvention?
I don't think I'm going to be able to make it.
No? Well?
Trying to fit in Huntsville, though.
Yep. Well, I'm trying to fit it in, too, since I've already booked a room over there.
I'll be in Huntsville. Unless something happens, but I plan on it.
Yeah. So, hope to see some of you out there in Dayton, and I know we will, because it always happens, and I didn't notice...
I didn't notice Chip in the chat room tonight.
What I was thinking.
You can get you some cool Dayton swag to wear and represent on the shop.spreadshirt. .com/amateurlogic, too.
Yeah. And if you want to know... If you'd like to know when we're going to be doing another show or anything's going on or maybe what's on some folks' mind, you can find that out by going to one of our social media sites, facebook.com/group/amateurlogic.tv.
Yeah, you can follow us at Amateurlogic on Twitter or X.
Or also...
Or groups. groups.io/g/amateurlogic.
Any of those places. In it, we mentioned show notes earlier, like that PDF I was looking at on the medium wave eclipse DXing and propagation there.
Yeah, how can I find that?
I'm glad you asked. There's a site that you can go that you can get all the show notes.
Oh, we have a show notes place?
We do. And you're the one who does it.
Oh, so, yeah. I forgot.
Well, I know how it goes. amateurlogic.tv/wiki. Go there for all your show note needs. And we will be back here around the middle of next month. Don't know the exact date because we haven't discussed it yet. And I will be in Dayton that weekend, so we might have to shuffle around a little bit on when the next episodes will be. But remember those social media sites we just mentioned. You can find out on any of these when the next episode will be. And we do hope you'll join us. Thanks for being here, everyone. 7-3.
7-3, everybody. Good night.
7-3.
7-3.